Turuntuset tulee Joonael.
Today we are going to talk about neuromarketing. And neuromarketing and scientific approach to marketing has been a topic where what we are touching here in the show for the first time, but I know that there are many, many people who have asked us about, can you find a person to talk about neuromarketing? And yes. Here you are.
Thank you.
So let's start from the very beginning. What is neuromarketing? What are we going to talk about today?
Well, I think it probably started in about the 1990s when the science started to get a little more refined. In all those of us in advertising, marketing, branding, my background, I started in Madison Avenue way back in the 70s. And what we looked at for many, many years was, how is the brain responding to advertising, to marketing, what people are saying? And as we started to get into do MRIs, brain scans, PET scans of the brain, we started to look at, could we judge what was going on in a customer's brain and relate it to what the marketing message was, and could we see what the changes were in the brain? Well, in truth, we've tried a lot of different things. You know, people look at color, they look at, you know, the size of the type, the different pieces. What really neuromarketing hasn't been that great, hasn't made great advantages. We don't, at the Advanced Learning Institute, we don't call what we do at neuromarketing really. We call it neurogenetics. Because what we found was you couldn't just look at the brain. You had to look at what created the brain, the genes. You had to look at evolutionary biology. You had to look at molecular biology. You had to even look into quantum physics, complexity, and chaos theory, because believe it or not, the cells themselves are driven by quantum physics. So we took a very deep dive. It's taken us 30 years to do the research.
Wow.
And while we use some of the research in marketing and branding, we also use it in education. We built the first school system in the world in Canada at Masters Academy, totally based on neuroscience. We're helping those in Afghanistan and Iraq that are wounded warriors with PTSD. We're using it in a lot of different areas. Because what we've done is we've taken the brain and reversed engineered how it responds to certain stimuli. And whether it's an education stimuli or a war stimuli or a marketing stimuli, by understanding the neurobiology of how the brain responds to certain stimuli, you can start to learn and be much more elegant at how you package, brand, and position your organization and your products.
Excellent. So how does it work? How does the neuromarketing work? What did you find out?
Well, so let me step back just a little bit.
Yeah, of course.
And so back in the 1980s, I read a guy named Peter Drucker, who was a famous American management guru. And he had said, look, we're in a knowledge society. And I started thinking, if we're in a knowledge society, the number one asset you can have in a knowledge society is your ability to learn. And if you can accelerate the speed of learning, you can accelerate it's not stocks or bonds or real estate that's of value, it's your ability to learn that's value. So I really started getting this idea that if I could accelerate the speed of learning and figure out the scientific basis behind it, then I could help not only education, but a lot of things in business. I've developed about 25 startups. And so what I found was if I went into a business and used more scientific-based programs, I could accelerate the way people learned about technology, about sales, about communications between one another, and even about marketing. So it's taken us, I thought I could do this in about 3 years, I could figure it out. This is back in the 1880s. It's taken us 30 years.
Okay.
And we basically found there's a code in your DNA. You've got 6 feet of DNA in each one of your cells. And please stop me if I use some terms that won't be translatable into Estonia.
Currently it is. The language is wide enough to,
okay.
to
so just stop me
have
if
science
I go in the
even
wrong
in
direction.
These parts. Okay.
Yes. So you've got about 6 feet of DNA in each one of your cells. And on these cells is a code. And when that code is turned on, it literally expresses proteins and enzymes that changes the shape of your brain. So if we are trying to get somebody to learn something, literally their brain has to change its shape. That code has to be turned on. When the code is turned on, it changes the neurochemistry of your brain. So really what we're doing in marketing, branding, and advertising, if what we're doing presenting to our potential customer isn't causing a biological change within them, we're wasting our time. And so what we did was we reversed engineered how to turn this code on so that we could cause those neurological and neurochemical changes in the customer's brain so that he would make a buying decision. So it's interesting. Think about it. You're going through a store. You're not thinking about buying something. And then you see something, and then you make a buying decision. The only way that can happen is if you have a biochemical change within you. So when we understood that, we started to look at how do we create those biochemical changes within people so they transform their buying decisions.
So, and how do you create the changes? The biochemical changes?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ways. So, and this is where really we, you know, those of us in marketing and advertising and sales can kind of get off track. We're so busy on trying to sell somebody something, we forget what it is we're selling. We're so aggressive. How do I get X into the customer's hands so we can sell X number of them so fast so I can make my bottom line and our profit can be this and we can grow our business and my stock goes up. And what we found was that really something had to happen first to be really successful with a product. And it wasn't necessarily the tricks you use to sell it. It was really the value that the product or service added to the society. If you look at the products that are dominating at the moment, value dominates. Apple, Google, Amazon. The more value a product adds, the greater the return. And this is where you kind of get into quantum physics a little bit. Really, the universe tends to support that which, you know, I don't want to get into all of that kind of science because it's pretty deep. But basically, it's almost a spiritual kind of thing. The more value you can, and really the research we've done on a lot of spirituality matches a lot of what quantum physics and even neuroscience is telling us. And that is, the more value you can add to the universe, the more energy you get back. And really, all money is green energy. So what we've found is kind of interesting, though we started just how do I get more people to buy something by changing their neurochemistry? When we really walked back down the line and said, what is really changing people's neurochemistry? It's really the value they perceive. And so if you as a marketer or a brander or a positioner starts looking at what value is my product giving to the market and is my product really of value or am I trying to sell something because my boss wants me to sell it? And a lot of us, and I've had many jobs, you know, I started first beating on doors, selling magazines. You know, this is before the internet. They would take me to, they'd take a bunch of us, we'd get in a car, this is during the Vietnam War. They'd drive us to a military base where all the men were in Vietnam. The mothers were home with kids. They were all bored. We'd knock on the door and I'd say, B, I bet you're bored. Would you like to get Ladies Home Journal or whatever? We'd sell them all these magazines. And I ended up being one of the top salesmen, but I felt like crap. I didn't feel very good about what I was doing, mainly because we were selling them something I knew they'd never have time to do. They ended up with 12 magazines when I left, you know, they'd get every month. They were never going to read them. And it was then, really, I was very young. I was probably 17, 16. And I started to think about this value idea. The funny thing was, I thought about it then. But then I did a lot of, you know, I've sold a lot of stuff. You know, we represented Brides magazines, the Washington Post. You know, we're in partnership with Time Warner in Hawaii and some television deals. So I did an awful lot of stuff. But as I got into the science, that first experience of my life that I'd had maybe 30 years before really started to ring true. And what we found is that if you can position your product to match what is most meaningful to your customer. The customer literally selects your product into their neural structures. You don't have to force it in.
How do you see the match?
Okay, we do a thing. Matter of fact, with Success Academy, this week we're going to be talking to some marketing and branding people about how you do it. But one of the interesting things is that you need to kind of understand your customer. And what we tend to do when we do focus groups and we bring everybody in a room and say, what do you want? A lot of times we don't really go deep enough. What we found is that everybody has what's called a meaning network, a group of structures in their brain that allows them to focus in the environment on what's meaningful to them. And if your product matches what's meaningful to your customer, then, as I said before, it'll select it in. So what we do first is, you would think we would start with our customer, but what we really do, and we've helped an awful lot of companies do this, we presented it at Turner Broadcasting, CNN, not long ago. We presented to a lot of different, media people. But what we found was, what's more important is what's meaningful to you as an organization. And what we don't tend to do is we don't take the time to figure out what's meaningful to us. We just go do it because we think we can make money and go on to the next thing and get the next car, the next house, and whatever. And we end up on a treadmill. We found if we can take time and figure out why is it we're in business, we nickname this the noble cause. What is your noble cause in your business? Now, why is this important from a neurological standpoint? The fascinating thing is that when the noble cause of my company, the Advanced Learning Institute, is transform the way the world learns and changes behavior based on neuroscience, based on science. Why? Because we think that the reason that Serbs fight Croats and Shiite fight, in each other in Iraq and Iran is because we don't realize we all want the same things. We all want a nice family, we want a nice home. We don't really have to be all this fighting. So we've got what deeply meaningful is very similar. But there is uniqueness to each form of who we are as an organization. We found companies have their own DNA. And each company will have a noble cause that's unique to it they may not even be aware of. People aren't aware. Everybody looks at Steve Jobs for making the change with Apple. But if you really look at behind what is behind Apple, it's helping transform humanity. Google has a very similar a similar kind of mission under a noble cause underneath. A lot of medical companies that are very successful are the ones that hold on to their noble cause of curing cancer or whatever it is, instead of focusing just on the bottom line. So what we do is we help companies first become very clear on what is your noble cause. And when they get clear about their noble cause, this literally accesses the most evolved part of your brain. It's really where the spiritual people put your third eye. It's a part of your brain called the ventral mental prefrontal cortex. And it's literally when you activate that part of your brain, you're able to see systems much better. As a businessman, you go, well, my noble cause, if it's curing cancer, or if it's making... I know Roland, who I'm working with Success Academy, one of his partners is in the lock business. If he recognizes he's not really in the lock business, he's in creating security for Estonia. His brain starts to shift. He starts to look at the world differently. He doesn't just look at locks. Then he can start looking at everything from computer security to child security. You can start looking at your whole space differently. And what we do is we help a company understand in their own integrity what their noble cause is, what's most important to them, why they get up in the morning, why they're passionate, what they care about. We get them very clear about that. Then we find out what's most meaningful to the customer. And where the two come together is really your brand. And if you can make your terminology match what is most meaningful to you and what's most meaningful to your customer, what your copy is, you know what your headline should be. It just makes everything so much easier.
What happens if they don't match? If the customer still says that I want the lowest price, I don't care about your meaning. Should we fire the customers and find the new ones?
No, not necessarily. You can, you know, life is a conscious decision. You can say, I want to make the cheapest products that don't work as well as the more expensive products because there's a need for my cheaper products. And then you can even wrap a noble brand around that because you're fulfilling a need. If there is a need and you fulfill it, not everybody can drive a Rolls Royce.
Yeah, absolutely.
Somebody's got to drive a Kia,
yeah, you know?
So it's perfectly fine. I think the trick is to do this without judgment, has been my experience, which opens up the space. You know, really, people are buying what they need, even if it breaks tomorrow.
Absolutely. You have in your theory thought one is about really about the kind of the meaningfulness that you have told. Then I read about the red trees.
Oh, yes,
let's talk
yes.
about the red trees a bit.
Okay.
What it's about and how does it? How did you learn about it?
Okay. So when we started looking at the genetic makeup, right, we found there were a set of genes. Now, I'm speaking in metaphors because the exact genes haven't been identified. Let me just go back just a little bit. We used to think when Watson and Crick are the two fellows that discovered the double helix of the DNA, the shape of the DNA back in the 50s, we thought there were over 100,000 genes. We thought each gene had to have one function, one for blue eyes, one to make you act a certain way, another to have you run fast or whatever. We now know there's only 20,000 genes and they all talk to one another. It's polygenetic. It's very confusing in there. We're still trying to unwind it. Think about it. In 6 feet of DNA, it scrunches up so small that you can barely see it with an electron microscope, and we're trying to figure out what it all does, right? So what we've found is that there, speaking metaphorically, there's literally a set of genes that force you to focus on what's novel in your environment. Why? Go back. The genes in you are literally the same genes that were in caveman or, you know, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, going back 6 million years. So the same genes that were in them are in us. The ancestors' genes that got passed to us, genes are like past learning sent forward. That's what genes are. So this is why you can suckle when you come out of the womb. Nobody taught you to do that. Nobody taught you to duck if somebody threw a rock at you. That's all pre-programmed stuff in your genes. That's all learning that you've already got in there. So what happens is, what we found was, that they were genes coded for novelty. Why? Because 6 million years ago, when our ancestors were walking through the savanna, those that paid attention to the rippling grass, they lived. That they paid attention to that novelty, their genes got passed down to us. Our ancestors who didn't pay attention to that novelty of the rippling grass, they got eaten. We don't have their genes.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Or fortunately.
Yeah, fortunately. Right. Well, listen, this is what's interesting. Every single generation, we've gotten more and more and more refined to pay attention to novelty. Now, Hollywood doesn't know this, but that's why they keep upping the violence and the sex. They have to. They have to keep making the novelty greater. So how do we use this in marketing and branding and positioning? Well, what we found was, we call it the red tree. Let me just go back. We call it the red tree theory because where I live in Colorado, there's a big mountain behind my house, and there's a bazillion green trees. And if I say, what's up on that mountain behind my house, people say, well, there's a lot of green trees. If there's one red tree, everybody says, there's a red tree up there. Why? The brain is forced to pick that out from a survival. So what we don't do a lot of times is we don't remember to position our company as a red tree. I don't know Estonian gas stations well. Are there a lot of different gas stations in Estonia?
Several. Not a lot of bits.
Right. So let's do it this way. When you're on vacation, where do you buy your gas?
Yeah, it depends. From the nearest gas
yeah,
station, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Nobody cares. If gasoline companies understood this, one of them would kick all the rest of them's butt. Because what they haven't done is none of them have a red tree brand. They all just sell gas. In America, it's Gas and Go, it's Citgo, it's Shell. Where do you go? You go, I go to which one's closest to the airport because I'm always on the road, right? So, and I go to the one closest to my house or when I'm out of gas. So nobody's branded anything. So what they haven't done is they haven't positioned themselves as a red tree, so they stand out in our brain. So what you want to do first is you want to brand yourself first in what we call the concept network of a buyer. So let me come back a little again. So what do I mean by concept network? If I was saying to you and your listeners right now, imagine biting into a lemon. Can you feel that?
Sour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you feel that? Can you smell it?
Yeah.
Can you almost feel that oil on the skin?
Yeah.
That literally is a concept network for lemons. That network of lemons, there's greener lemons and there's limes, they're close together. It fits into a larger network for fruit. So those are literally fats and proteins that are making you feel, that are firing and making you feel that taste in your mouth, right? So if we're trying to figure out how to brand something, right? Let me come back. What we want to do is make sure that we fire the right concept network for fruit. So let me ask you a question. Do you have a favorite fruit?
Yes.
What?
Let's say it's strawberry.
Is it strawberry?
Might say that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so do you have a second favorite fruit?
I don't know, yeah.
Okay, what is that?
It's apple.
Okay. So are there any other things in your life that, what do you like to do when you're not at work?
Picking fruits.
Do you? You're serious?
I have a garden. I pick fruits every morning.
Oh, that's great. Are you probably flowers then? Do you like flowers too?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of flowers. I have trees.
Okay.
It's a beautiful garden.
Okay. So I won't go into any deeper for time, but literally the strawberries and the apples were first and second in a concept networking in your brain for fruit. Everybody that you ask usually has some different organization of it. After one and two, we get lost. So we call it the Hertz strategy of marketing and branding. Back in the 80s and 90s, Hertz labeled itself number one. We're number one, they said. Why were they number one? Well, back then they were number one because they said they were number one. But what it forced people to do was put Hertz first in their concept network for rent-a-cars. So we literally have genes called hierarchical genes that force us to put things first in a concept network. Like I love cars, right? And I love Range Rovers because I like to go off the road, you know? And so I'm going to have something first in my concept network for cars. If the people that are listening to this radio show, if you think about things you like, you're going to have things you like first and second, maybe third, and then usually it all schmoozes out. You get lost. So if you haven't branded yourself first in the concept network of your buyer, you're in trouble. It's really hard to get them to pay attention to you. And we use this red tree strategy to get novelty. In other words, how do we make ourselves stand out over and above all the other gas stations, all the other rent-a-cars, all the other shoe companies? Now, a lot of companies are doing this, but most of them are doing it unconsciously. They're doing it because they've got somebody famous like Ralph Lauren in Polo. You know, they pulled out their own red tree a lot of times by accident. All we've done with the science is figure out how anybody can do this for their product. What you need to know is your product, whether it's cars, whether it's shoes, you know, whether it's, we were talking a second ago, whether it's locks, how to put somebody first put your business first in their concept network, have it stand out as a red tree. Now, what we found was, this is fascinating, what we found was that that just having you be a red tree wasn't enough, having you stand out. And this is where we go back to meaning again. What we found out was, I don't know if you had this in Estonia, have you ever heard of the pet rock?
No.
Oh, this guy was a nutcase. This guy back in the 80s, late 1980s, he had this idea that he got a rock, He painted a face in it. He put it in a box. He went to China and had them make a bazillion of them. And he sold them at Christmas. And he said, this is a pet you can have. You don't have to feed. You don't have to love. You can still have a pet and not do anything with it. It was just something stupid. But he sold a bazillion of them because it was like a red tree. It was so silly back then. And it stood out. I met him once in Hawaii, as I remember, and where I used to have an office. And he said, you know, J.W., I'm going to start do the next pet rock, my next great idea, right? And he went out, and I think he spent most of his money. I don't know whatever he did, but you never heard from him again. Why? Because he never, you know, it was luck that got him to do that. And the other thing was the pet rock only lasted for about 25 weeks. It sold hundreds of thousands in a short time, and it was gone. Why? Because the pet rock was not connected to meaning. So for you, strawberries have a lot of meaning. It's the taste, it's the look, it's the smell. It's firing a lot of networks in your brain. Same thing for women in certain shoes. Where I live in Colorado, in Boulder, there's a company, Crocs, that makes these really soft, gushy shoes.
Yeah.
And so they have meaning for a lot of people. A lot of people in Boulder, they're number one in their shoe concept network, the way they feel, the way they touch, even the way they smell. So when we're building a product, what we want to do is we want to be as high up as we can in their concept network. Then what we want to do is we want to make it so we fire as much of the brain as possible. Not just, you know, is it, you know, a good gas station? You know, why is it a good gas station? What does it do for me? What else does it, we call them mini brands that the main brand sits on top of. Steve Jobs didn't know this either, and Apple still probably doesn't. But the reason Apple has become the number one brand in the world is it has hundreds of mini brands, or 10 anyhow. In other words, it's got Apple TV, it's got the iPod, it's got the iPhone, it's got the iWatch. These all create mass for a brand that the brain takes in and gives it really form for the brain to aggregate around. So if you can look at this kind of what you're trying to do is get first in a concept network, stand out as a red tree, connect it to meaning, then you're much farther down the road if you just sit in a meeting and try to figure out how we're going to sell this product tomorrow. You got something to work with.
Absolutely. Can you bring some good example?
I used like Apple, and in America we've got a fascinating company called Zappos, which is selling shoes. And go back to the noble cause I was talking about. They identified in their company what was most meaningful to them. Do you know what it is?
Customer.
Right, but you know what else?
Customer happiness.
Happiness. It's not selling shoes. Their job is to deliver happiness. Have you ever seen pictures of their office?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, these guys are throwing frisbees.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've got goofy hats on. They're just having a blast. And so what they're delivering to the customer really isn't shoes. Their noble cause is happiness. So now for shoes, who is going to stand out first when I'm online and I know I'm going to get shoes and I know if they don't fit, it's going to cost me money. I got all these things to worry about. With Zappos, you don't worry about any of that stuff. You call up a customer service person and say, I'm not happy with the shoes. They go, good, we'll send you another pair. You know, and not only the customer's happy, but the employees are happy. If more companies would understand you make money by adding value and following a noble cause, this world would be a lot better. I mean, it sounds like what we're trying to do with we call the neurogenetics of marketing and branding is sell more products. But what we're trying to do is get companies to understand by adding more value, the joy and the ability to make money goes up dramatically. Your green energy comes back. So, and one reason you notice that that Amazon, though it's developing, you know, people bring, when I bring this noble cause stuff up and people go, what about Amazon? All they care about is making money. Well, they do. But look at, I don't know if you've noticed all the flack they're getting recently. Have you noticed what's happened with Amazon?
A bit, probably.
In America, the New York Times released an article about how miserable and beat up all the employees felt
working there. This was referred also.
And they're going to get more and more of that because they don't have much of a noble cause. So therefore, they don't treat their people very nobly. I don't know a lot about them, but that's what I've been reading. But I'll tell you from what I have read that they're creating a neurological environment where productivity is decreasing, where efficiency is decreasing, where people's sick days are increasing, where stress levels are increasing, where innovation is going down. Because that part of the brain I talked to before about that prefrontal lobe, the more joy you have, the more you feel like you're doing something noble, the more this prefrontal lobe is activated, the lower your stress hormones. And strangely enough, the higher your innovation and creativity and productivity.
So everyone should achieve the happiness in the company.
Happiness is usually a byproduct of fulfillment.
Okay.
There's some great research of people that chase happiness aren't very happy. People that chase value, chase fulfillment, are happy. So we've got it wrong. And what's really hurting our society is that we're chasing the next fast car to get happy. We're chasing the next bigger house to get happy. And the truth is, we get unhappier. We can't go outside to get it. We've been tricked. We've been duped, you know. From my world in biology, you just can't do it by getting more crap. You wouldn't believe all the multimillionaire people I know that are the most miserable suckers in the universe.
Absolutely.
You know?
So we have talked about branding and about the meaning. But you as a salesman, a previous salesman, a very successful one, how do you use the neuromarketing in sales?
Well, here's what we don't have to sell as much, really. Really, for my company at the Advanced Learning Institute, we're adding so much value, I haven't ever made a sales call.
And so we've got too much business. Just coming to you.
Yes.
Okay.
So we use a strategy, really, that I got. Are you familiar with 12-step programs over here? Alcoholics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous?
No, unfortunately or fortunately.
They're tremendous programs in really all over the world. And they have a 12-step process of really Roland Access Academy has come up with a kind of a 12-step process and for helping people in business. But this 12 seems to be a number a lot of people are hitting on. But they have a 12-step program to help people recover from diseases of alcoholism and food addiction, those kinds of things, sex addiction, gambling. And one of the things that they don't do is they don't advertise. And back in the 30s when they were first started, it stemmed out of a guy named, really his last name was Wilson too, Bill Wilson. And he said, we're going to get people to know about us, not through promotion, but through attraction. And that stuck with me. I developed one of the first holistic treatment centers in America. We treated patients, I don't know if you know this, but most treatment centers treat these initially with drugs. You know, we use drugs and those kinds of things. We only used acupuncture, nutrition, yoga, meditation to treat people. And what I found, and this is where I got very familiar with these 12-step programs, and that idea we promote through, we get our word out through attraction, not promotion, always stuck with me. It resonated with me. And what I found was that the more you do this noble cause stuff, you know, you do the red tree thing, you know what your own integrity is, you know what's meaningful to you and your customer, the less you have to focus on sales. It's almost like the universe is supporting what you're doing. Let me use an example from quantum physics, really.
Okay.
And here's what's happening. Newton kind of discovered mass attracts mass. Sir Isaac Newton, you know, back in the 1600s. Basically, he was sitting in his garden. There was a plague in London, and he was hiding from it, and he noticed that an apple fell from the tree to the earth. And he goes, gravity. The earth is stronger. It's sucking the apple down. Well, many years later, 200 and some, I think, Einstein had a whole different theory as we were starting to understand what quantum physics was. What he saw was that the universe was in time and space, was more like a sheet. Imagine that you're holding one end of a sheet and I'm holding the other end of a sheet. And we're both holding it very tight. And our friend Roland here throws in a bowling ball in the middle. What happens to that sheet? It literally warps. It literally changes the shape of the sheet, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what Einstein was saying, what mass was really doing was it was literally altering the shape of the universe. So what gravity really was that if there were small golf balls at the top of our sheet and we threw the bowling ball in the middle, what would the golf balls do?
I don't know. To fall to the middle.
They'd all fall to the middle, right? So what we've found is this attractions theory. If you can build your brand up with enough mass, and mass now as we kind of get into a little bit more of that spiritual stuff, it doesn't have to be necessarily all these products, but your integrity is high enough. It's almost as if you're warping the universe so it better supports what you're having to offer. And so what we do with the marketing brand, we develop mini brands. We try to literally create mass for the brand. And we can get into some examples of that. But we try to create mass for the brand so that we're literally attracting other mass. But really, what we're doing in Einstein's terms is we're warping the universe. And therefore, you don't have to work as hard. And it's kind of fast. It's, you know, this, there's no doubt what we're doing is on the edge, right? And the way we're talking is on the edge. But it's just a refreshing, exciting way to look at things. And yes, we made a lot of mistakes trying to figure this out, but we're applying it. We're finding tremendous results. We've had some websites that are starting to use this that have had over 100% increase in conversion rates on their websites using this strategies. You know, it's just a different way to look at what we're doing in our lives.
Very good. What is the future of the research? Where is the research heading, and what are you hoping to discover during next 10 years?
It's a great point. Here's the reason you haven't heard much about us is we've stayed under the radar for 30 years on purpose. You know, we've been applying this, using it, doing the research. What I would do is I'd go out and I'd develop a business, I'd make some money, I'd come back, and then we'd do the research, okay. And then I'd do it again, because nobody was funding this, because the truth was, we didn't really know what we were doing. But what I think some people have likened this to the discovery of the double helix, or the Rosetta Stone, you know, the Rosetta Stone that was made, and we figured out how to decipher hieroglyphics in Egypt. We have a book coming out called Cracking the Learning Code within the next year, and we'll have an online series that will really make this available to everybody. We have 14 books and 14 online programs to help people transform and understand this, and everything from education to marketing and branding. And we believe now that we have enough that we can, and enough of the science, that we can I don't know exactly, but we've probably gone through to get this research literally 100,000 research papers to get all of this. We don't literally do the research ourselves. We take it and decipher it, everything from pharmacological research to brain damage research to genetic research. And we believe in this book that we've laid out what this learning code is and for how anybody to turn it on. And then we're taking pieces of the major book and applying it to different stratas, like whether it's education or marketing or whatever, or addiction. So we think we're there. We don't want to make it bigger than it is. But it's like when we discovered that the brain and genes work on natural selection with Darwin. Once you figured that out, you could apply it to a lot of different things. We think, and once we release this, that everybody will be able to start to apply this more effectively. We think our organization, we want to kind of be like we still want to lead this and help it. Our goal is to disseminate this as much as we can, because we think we can take a lot of pain out of marketing, branding, sales. I mean, sales is a lot of work.
Yeah, of course it is.
Oh, my God. I mean, you know, you got to get up in the morning, you get yourself in the mirror, you go, I'm the most best, kill this guy, you know? And that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work, and it's not necessarily that natural. And some people are natural salespeople. you know, and they're going to be always natural salespeople. What we found when we did the research, everybody goes, how do we make everybody better salespeople? Let's reward them. Let's punish them, you know. And what we found was, no matter what the reward or punishment guy was, the same 10% always were the best salesman.
Okay, good. Very good. My very last question for this part comes from a completely different field. And this is the tradition, what we do, that's just challenging you. And my question is that, what do you think, how should neuromarketing be used in marketing a creative company, a company in a creative field?
Ooh, that's a great question. So here's what I think. If you are a creative company, the science is pretty clear. When you're under stress, the top of your adrenal gland gives off a hormone called cortisol. It goes into your brain. I wish I could show you a picture on radio here, but imagine your brain, and imagine when you're under stress that the middle and the lower part of your brain gets on fire. It literally lights up red. If I put you in a PET scan and then colored it, or fMRI and colored it, it would definitely, you know, you'd go, wow, that's what happens when I'm under stress. Why don't you want a creative company to be under stress? Because the higher the stress level, the more the blood flow is in the middle and the lower part of your brain. Some people call it the reptilian and the mammalian part of your brain. That's the most inflexible part of your brain. That's the part of your brain that can't see the consequences of my present actions. That's the kind of part of my brain that reacts without thinking. Okay, it's a very important part of our brain. If a bear ran in this room and we all dove out the window, that would, without thinking, that would be a pretty good move to get away from. Well, maybe not, because I think we're
not from a dead floor.
Should rethink. But if you want to create, you want a creative environment. Literally, people have to be under lower stress. Why? Because the lower the stress that comes off this top of the adrenal gland, this lower this cortisol level, the more the prefrontal, the most evolved part of the brain is engaged. And that's where innovation comes from. That's where creativity comes from. That's how we created Twitter. Those guys weren't under pressure. When they first did first Facebook, they weren't under pressure. The creativity really comes from this joyous space of low stress, but with a vision of something. And so what a lot of, I've got friends of mine, you know, I've been in the advertising business forever, back in the day, and not so much anymore. But I'd go into these guys' offices, and it was painful. And funny, I just wrote about this the other day, or was editing a piece, where a buddy of mine I met with, I explained to him what was going on. When the stress goes up, creativity goes down. He goes, JW, just explained to me my last 7 years in my advertising agency. And this guy had been, you know, different advertising agencies get run by different people, as you might know. Sometimes it's the creative guys, sometimes it's the sales guys, sometimes it's the accounting guys. The accounting guys seem to be winning out at the moment. but he was a creative guy that ran this really very creative agency. And he said, JW, just explain my life to me. I go, what do you mean? He goes, for the last 7 years, I've felt myself get less and less and less creative. As my stress levels have gone up, I've got more employees. I'm trying now, my business is doing pretty well, but me personally, he said, I just don't feel very creative. I don't feel like I'm really doing what I want to do in my life. And what I helped him understand was that when that stress hormone level goes down, literally your brainwave patterns change. In this radio studio where we're now, we're focusing on, Jeff, you have your technician worried about when I just sneezed or burped or whatever I just did. And you've got, you know, you're focusing on what to ask me, and I'm focusing on answering your questions right so I don't sound like an idiot. So our brain is in what's called beta state. These waveforms are going very, very fast in our brain. When I relax and I slow down, my brain goes into slow wave states, alpha, theta, delta. They're much slower. And when the brain goes into these slow wave states, a neurochemical comes forward that allows the neurons to communicate without restraint, which allows us to make connections between neurons that weren't made before. that makes allows us to make connections between a world that wasn't made before. So I went back and researched every great discovery that I could find. I mean, I got a little obsessive compulsive doing this because I'd finish these companies and then I'd disappear for 2 or 3 years. I mean, my partners were a little concerned about me. But I went back in, you know, to Greek times, to Archimedes when he was trying to figure out how to weigh gold. And he sat in the bathtub and watched the water rise. That was in a relaxed state. The sewing machine in a relaxed state. The printing press was in a relaxed state. The benzene molecule, Einstein, you know, figuring out that the theory of relativity by watching clouds on his back. I couldn't find any great discovery of mankind that was made in a beta state. Now, there may be some. I just couldn't find them. Now, it didn't mean that they didn't input the information in a beta state, but the creativity came from these slow wave alpha, theta, delta states. And that was fascinating to me. So if I was a creative agency and I wanted to kick everybody else's butt in creativity, I'd make sure that I had relaxation chairs and massage guys. You know, I'm not sure how I would do it, but I'd be very aware of the science. On our website, Cracking the Learning Code, you can just Google Cracking the Learning Code and find it. You'll see that, you know, there's a section where we talk a little bit about that. You know, until recently, we've kept this website and a lot of things under the radar. But, you know, you can go on there and get a sense that if I am able to keep myself in a more of a relaxed state, my innovation is going to go through the roof. And my team's innovation is going to go through the roof. The trick is, how do we do that? How do we keep innovation, you know, how do we keep people's brains in an alpha state in a beta world, right? And I don't know, people ask me that I think I got a lot. I don't have the answers. I think I understand how the systems work. So we're just going to have to figure that out. How do we do it? But by understanding it, it sure makes you at least know what we should not be doing and maybe what we should be doing.
Absolutely. Thank you a lot. And thank you for really encouraging us to go in depth with science.
Yeah, thank you.
And looking and trying to understand what is behind that. So it was really encouraging interview. Thank you.